introduction I've ever had.
Normally, I was expecting some heartwarming kind of stuff. And I know you're going to tell me if I screw this up. I count on you. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to see you. And I am kind of shocked by the lack of introduction. Good God. I usually want heartwarming stuff, you know, so everybody's just juicing up. And he says, go get them. I'm going to talk as fast as I can. Clace is interpreting, and I hope he can hurry. Now, I'll think I'm talking fast. It won't sound like it to you, but it's going to be really fast for me. I want to share a lot of stuff with you, and I want to talk a lot about being drunk, too. The theme of this conference is more about alcoholism. The theme of this talk is more about alcoholism, because that's what my life's about. And I am really pleased to be in a conference of this nature. It's kind of a special time for me. Somebody asked me about how long I'd been sober. And at 8:30 last week in the morning, that marked the 49th year since my last drink. And thank you. Yeah, thank you very, very much. I don't really celebrate that day, but it just struck me as ironic that I was in an AA meeting on the exact day, and now a week later I'm here. But I don't celebrate that because that was my last drink. My first meeting was 2 months later in February of '57, and when I went to there. And what I celebrate is my recovery. I found that there's a big difference between not drinking and recovery from alcoholism. And so I celebrate February 2nd, Groundhog Day. Excuse me, 1 minute. I don't count that on the tape. You suppose that's sanitary? I'll take a chance. I know health prevails in Copenhagen. Okay, now I'm ready to go to work. So it is kind of a momentous kind of a time. And I want to share with you, I really want to build around something I was thinking about, that I'm becoming one of the older rats in the barn very quickly. And it's amazing to me that a guy like me could stay sober this long. It is just as amazing, if not more amazing, that I could be sober this long and still be loving every minute of it. I'm as active in AA as I have ever been in my life. I'm as dynamically involved, I'm as excited about it, I'm as enthused about it as I've ever been. I'm visiting the fourth dimension as much as I ever have. And some folks will tell you that when you come into AA, there's a kind of a predictable honeymoon period, you know, where you just sort of fall in love. And that fairly predictably, it'll come to an end. Well, I want to bear witness to you that that is not necessarily true. Now, I don't think I'm the village idiot, but my honeymoon period, my pink cloud, has never ended. I think it lasts as long as I do the things that make it happen and won't run out. And so I want to kind of, I think, explain about how on earth could that happen to some dude with struggling on 49 years? And so I want to build it around that. But let me tell you how it started. I'm a fairly typical alcoholic. I don't think I'm radically different than anybody else. We come in two basic types. One is the slow grower. There's some people that just sort of look like they drink their way into it. They drink with relative control for many years and then go off the deep end and don't come back up. That's a real alcoholic. There's another kind, of which I think I was an early model. I was one of those basket case types from day one. And so the first time I ever drank in my life, I don't think I was an alcoholic, but I drank like one. It's because that stuff just did something wonderful for me. What booze constituted for me was a real solution to all the problems of my life. Now, I'm not going to go into a whole bunch of anything, really, but I'm not going to go into a bunch of causation for sure. Not that I dismiss it. You know, I think causation is a very legitimate concern in Alcoholics Anonymous. And practically everybody ever hear speaking, AA talks about that early awkward period of childhood when they were uncomfortable with life. I was no different. I found this world a very difficult, uncomfortable place in which to live. You know, I'd been affected by my environment in such a way that I found life tough going sometimes. You know, we all experience, and I'll just go this far with causation, that you know, everybody is influenced by the environment they grew up in and their early experiences, of course. And sometimes the things that happen to us cause us to respond and become stronger. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes the things that happens are embarrassing or difficult to deal with, and we internalize them and hold on to them. And they become what we call defects of character. And so that was certainly the way I was. I was a guy who was just sort of ill-equipped. Some of the dents and bangs of my life set me up to develop some coping behaviors so that I could function in life. And I became a guy with a lot of problems on the inside, and I hid them very well on the outside. And so that's an uncomfortable way to live. You can't walk around with disabilities without doing something about it. So when I found booze, it's no mystery to me now why I drank so much from the beginning, because it just did a lot for me. And what I found in booze was a marvelous solution. And unlike some people, it never quit being a solution for me. I think the saddest thing I ever hear in AA is people who say that it quit working for me. God, that's pitiful when an alcoholic can't find a solution in alcohol. I always got what I wanted. It always worked for me. Unfortunately, it started working overtime. And it started curing problems before it even happened, and the treatment lasted a lot longer than the condition. So it worked for me awfully well. And so when I started to drink, I just fell in love with the stuff. I immediately formed a romance with alcohol, and I still am not an enemy of alcohol. You know, I'm all for it, for somebody else, not for me. I encourage people to drink. They better not let me serve them a drink unless they really want one, because I'll give them one like I would want. I don't mind that, because I just sort of consider that my personal recruiting program for AA. That's the only way I know to get here is drink your way here. So I do that. I'm not mad at booze. I like booze, and as long as somebody else is drinking it. I just took off. And my life just sort of ran away like a runaway train. It never was any success and failure and peaks and valleys and all that. I started out at the bottom and just kind of stayed there. And I just drug along. And in the course of it, some rough stuff happened. I loved the scene where people, I loved everything about drink. I loved the people who drank, loved the trashy behavior. I loved everything about it. And I tell you something, I would be drinking tonight, except for one thing. I developed alcoholism. Now, like we were talking about it in the panel today, you know, more about alcoholism, that I don't pretend to be highly knowledgeable about alcoholism. The one thing I know about it that's more important than everything else I know overwhelmingly is that I have it. And I can't explain it, I can just report it. There was something happened to me when I was 18 years old, best I can tell. I didn't notice at the time because I think I was quite drunk when it happened. But something happened when I was 18. We refer to it as crossing a line. You know, I was just a wild, crazy party animal guy just charging ahead, screwing up everything I got close to. And I was in the military. I was stationed. You think it's cold in Denmark? It is balmy. I was stationed in the Aleutian Islands, which are in the Bering Sea, and they have no reason for existing whatsoever. They serve no purpose. The only purpose they serve is to take nice boys from the deep south and freeze them to death up there. Dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. That was my patriotic duty, to stand on a rock in the Bering Sea and shoot somebody if they want to try to steal a rock. You know, I wouldn't have shot them. I'd have helped them load the thing up. No way I'd fight for it. But I mean, that's what happened. Now, I don't think that caused my alcoholism, but I think it aggravated the situation a bit. I think it probably accelerated enough that I probably was 10 years ahead of my time because, man, I'm telling you, I was miserable. I drank like a fish. And somewhere in that process, best I can tell, not the amount of my drinking, but the nature of my drinking changed. Brian referred to it today. The nature of my drinking changed. And what happened was, I really don't know whether it was physical, physiological, neurological, biological, epidemiological, or whatever. I have no clue. But something happened that we refer to as crossing a line. And from that point forward, the best I can tell, if I took one drink, I could not predict what I would do. Not how much I drank, how long I drank, what I would do when I drank. Could not predict. Now, I didn't know that. I paid absolutely no attention to it, got into a lot of trouble. My drinking just created a lot of occupational hazards. They just go with somebody being as drunk as me. And so I went to a lot of jails, went to psych wards because people thought my behavior was funny. I thought it was a party. They thought it was really goofy behavior. So I started waking up in rooms with soft walls every once in a while, hospitals with stuff broken that I didn't even know had been injured. And so I was just crashing through. And what I didn't notice was as I crashed through, my life was just steadily ratcheting down. I was the kind of guy that on a given day, if I got sober, I was young and I've always looked young. Most people don't believe I'm 85 years old. God, I hope not. I'm only 63. And the truth is somewhere in between. But I look good. Yeah, I would sober up, and I mean, no matter how bad I'd been, all at once I'd look like a world beater. Yeah, it feels like a world beater after a little while. And I've always been overrated. I still am. I mean, people think I know stuff. Shoot, I don't know anything. I just talk it to death. And sounds knowledgeable. Yeah, but people would overrate me. I'd ask for a job. They'd give me a better job than I'm looking for. And then I would work my way down. That's God's truth. I don't remember ever having a promotion in my life. I don't remember it if I did. I never had a pay raise unless they raised a minimum wage or something. So I was not on a roll vocationally. But that kind of stuff was going on. And it's a strange thing when you're like a runaway train. It's hard to describe it as a subtle process. But it really is. Now, I read a thing one time that just kind of resonated with me, that the chains of habit go on so gently that we don't feel them till they're too strong to break. Now, mine wasn't certainly no gentle process. Mine was an absolute a disaster just going from town to town. Yeah, and so it wasn't subtle. But what was subtle was what was happening to me. That thing we were talking about today about delusion and illusion. The thing that's really significant to me about that is that no matter how bad my consequences became, I never saw them in clear focus. You know, what am I talking about? When I started to develop blackouts, and I would come to, in whatever circumstance I was in, with that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, when I would come to, I would never think, geez, I shouldn't have started drinking. Never entered my mind. I always thought that it was essentially a moral kind of an issue with me, that I just didn't have character or discipline or responsibility. I just thought I was just a loser of a guy. I never put together that if I took a drink, something happened to me that didn't happen to other people. And I didn't understand any of that. All I knew is I was just crazy head. And the fact of the business is, until I got sober in AA, I never clearly saw that behavior until well after the fact. I never came to a realization with horror that my life is falling apart. You know, I thought it was just an incredible lack of worth on my part and a lot of bad circumstances. I really never did think I was out of control. Every time somebody captured me and put me away somewhere in hospitals or psych wards or wherever or jails, every time anybody captured me and started to evaluate, I always got the same diagnosis. It was always, man, you're a bad drunk. You're an alcoholic. You're a problem drinker. I'd heard that over and over and over. It never meant a thing to me. Not a single thing. I was thrown out of the military for undesirable discharge for alcoholism when I was a 20-year-old young fellow. Didn't mean a thing to me. Yeah, I thought that what I had done was slick my way out of there because I didn't like it anyway. And it was mutual because they didn't like me anyway. And I'm telling you, I was a bad soldier. They found me one day on a rifle range firing my rifle the wrong direction. That is not nice behavior. So this whole thing is just crashing ahead. And I wound up, it won't mean a thing in Copenhagen, but I wound up living, at least I hope it don't. Is anybody here from Flint, Michigan? Huh? Flint, Michigan? No. Flint, Michigan? I mean, I know you'd go a long way to get out of Flint, Michigan. But that's where I wound up. And I'll tell you why I say that's kind of a bad place to wind up. At one time, Flint, Michigan was voted by whoever votes the worst city in the United States in which to live. And when that thing made the list, I kind of felt proud. You know, I thought, well, at least I contributed to that. You know, I helped. It was just an obscure little old Midwestern town. You know, until I came along and helped to make the bottom. And so, got to be proud of something. But that's where I wound up. When I thrown out of the military, I just wandered around with people like me, and I wound up in Michigan. No purpose. I was just there. And I worked in automobile stuff for a while, and God knows I hate to think of the people that bought the cars I had anything to do with. It was a bad period for motor vehicles in this world. And I wound up in that state, in that city. In that state, I was all over it, but unemployed and darn near unemployable. And the last couple of years that I drank, I'm not proud of it by any stretch of the imagination. Not stretch of it, but any stretch. But the last couple of years that I was there, I used to say I lived by my wits, but that's a little euphemistic for the way I live. You know, when my reputation got ahead, I couldn't get employment in any decent place to work in that city because my record was known and easy to track. And I wound up, rather than living by my wits, I wound up basically living on other people by whatever method. And I lived a street existence for that last couple of days. You know, I mean, I had a few addresses, the county jail was a very common address. There was a place called the Rialto Theater that was a very nice entertainment center. I think they ran the same movie all the time. Nobody cared because it was just a hotel for street characters. Yeah. Had my shoes stolen there. Now, I never have stolen shoes. I wasn't that bad. I quit before I got that bad. But sure had mine stolen. And so that's where I wound up doing. I wound up sort of taking advantage of any kind of manipulative skills that I had and using people. Yeah, I made a real art of taking advantage of good-hearted people that wanted to help me. If somebody wanted to help me, I would sure let them, and they would regret it. You know, I had a capacity to get ladies to take care of me and take me in, and there were interesting times. And yeah, I'm not proud of any of that. And when I wasn't doing that kind of thing, when you live in that kind of a world, you survive by the rules of that world. I wasn't someone who was born or reared in a criminal environment. And what I did during those 2 years, I honest to God, don't really consider criminal behavior. It's just the way it works. If you live on a street, you live by the rules of the street or you don't live. And in that environment, you were either being rolled by somebody else or you're rolling them. I mean, it's just the food chain. It's the way it works. And so I wound up doing that. That would have been totally unthinkable to me at one time. But you talk about illusion and delusion. By the time I got there, strange thing, that seemed the only normal life. I would see somebody going to work with a lunch bucket or taking kids to school or something like that. That looked abnormal. my life seemed the only normal one. And to any observer, it would look like an idiot on parade. But it's a strange thing about the illusion of this, it's going to get better. One day it's all going to be over, and I'll be the rocket scientist I was intended to be. Those are the fantasies that were going on. And so I'm just crashing ahead. And I think you've seen the picture enough that this was a wild and crazy young man. I don't believe I would have lived to 30. I thought that when I was drunk. People like me don't become old drunks. And so I crashed ahead till finally I wound up doing the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this room has feared. And probably most non-alcoholics in this room who lived with alcoholism have feared even more. And that's doing damage that's irreparable, that just can't be fixed. Now, I always knew I was capable of anything. I knew that. But I, like anybody else, I never believed that anything unthinkable would happen. I'm not an insensitive person, and human life was always important to me. In my worst days, human life was important. And so I knew, I mean, I was like anybody else with those things of coming to from blackouts and that panicky feeling. I don't know of anything more terrible in all of alcoholism than blackouts and that panicky feeling when you come to and have no clue where you are. Or worse yet, no clue of what you might have done. And how many of us do you hear describe that feeling and going out to look at the car to see if it's there, if there's blood on it, or it's wrecked, or something like that. Done it hundreds of times. And then would always breathe a sigh of relief, go do it again. Thank God for most alcoholics, those horrible, scary thoughts are bad dreams. And they'd never happen. But all too often, they do. And I was one of those. I came to one morning in jail there in Flint. No novelty there. That was common. And so I came to, assumed that I was there for the same as always. Either drunk on the street or hustling or scuffling, whatever, you know, rolling somebody. Just the usual stuff. And so when I came to, it was routine. I was no panic. I just sort of came to it and I wandered up to the front of the bars, and the jailer came by, a guy I knew quite well. And I said, hey, when can I get out? And he would normally say 10 o'clock, but that day he said, I hope never. And I had no clue what he was talking about. No clue. He didn't say anything. He just went on. And I walked back into the tank, they call it. Walked back into the tank. And I guess some of the guys in there had read the newspaper, and the headlines were that a drunken driver was driving up the main street of that city and ran down and killed two pedestrians trying to cross the street. Now, I never imagined. I mean, I knew something like that could happen, but I could never imagine it really happening. And when that happened, I guess my mind did what a mind will instinctively do. I just could not accept the information. I could believe it, but I couldn't accept it. And that was the first time. And then gradually I accepted the fact that you know, I'd done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. I had committed a crime for which there's no suitable punishment. There is none. How do you adequately punish somebody for taking two lives? And so when I was greeted with that and started to get even any thoughts about me, I was so deeply ashamed to be breathing, much less thinking of it. The only time I'd ever been in jail, I didn't try to get out. I didn't want out. I didn't know how to say that to anybody, but I didn't want out. You know, my family lived hundreds of miles away, and they didn't know where I was. They usually didn't know where I was, but they certainly didn't at that time because I made no effort whatsoever. And all I wanted to do was just be gone, to disappear. And for some reason, some policeman in there took it on himself. He learned that I had family in North Carolina. He learned who they were, called it. He didn't learn it from me. But he learned it from somewhere. He called them, said, you got a guy up here in a lot of trouble. And if you want to help him, you better come on, you know, because he's talking himself into more. Because anybody, I mean, I had nothing left. I mean, somebody asked me, did you do that? Oh, yeah, probably did, you know, just whatever. I mean, I was just a lifeless piece of humanity. And it was not scrambling or trying to do anything. So my family came, like families often do, and posted what I hope and pray was... Excuse me, the last bond they'll ever have to post. Wasn't the first one, but it was the last one, I hope. And now I didn't know how to tell them I didn't want out of jail. How do you say that to somebody? I couldn't. And I knew when I walked out, it was July 17th of 1956. And I knew the day I walked out of there that I would never drink again. It had nothing to do with alcoholism. But how on earth could you possibly drink after something as horrendous as that? The better question is, how would you not drink after something? But I didn't know that. I had no clue. But the most foreign thing that I could have imagined would be to take another drink. I lasted till about noon the next day. I walked the streets all night. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't stand to face anybody. And about noon the next day, I started to drink. And on July 8th, I got out on the 17th. On the 18th, I was as drunk as any human's ever been. And tried my level best to stay that way. Until 1 week ago, 49 years ago, on that day, I was to be tried on the charge of manslaughter. As I went to court, it was no trial in terms of prosecution and defense. I had no defense. I couldn't even tell them what I had done or deny what the hell of blackouts is. You don't know. And so I went in and listened to the trial, just like the people on the jury. And when he got through with it, I was convicted of, and I didn't have no question in my mind. I mean, I just listened to what said. I would have convicted me. I had no question. And then they passed a sentence, and I was sentenced to prison for a max of 15 years. I'd been a real character, as you probably gathered. I'd been a real character. So being locked up was nothing new. There's nothing shocking about that. But this was different. This was not an overnight drunk tank or a 30 days in a pea farm or a stockade in the military. It wasn't that. I knew that I was going to a pretty bad news joint. I was going to the maximum custody penitentiary in Jackson, Michigan. And while I'd never been there, I knew some people who were there, and they weren't the kind of folks going to make a nice community. And so I knew when I walked into that place the next day on the 20th of November, I walked in there, I honest to God believed it would be a one-way trip, that I would never live to come out of there, and I truly did not care. And it wasn't callous disregard or anger or anything like that. I was just totally defeated. I was totally beat and couldn't justify anything about even being here. And so they just filed me away like so much human wreckage. And I am absolutely convinced that I would put in that entire sentence and would have never lived to get out of there except for what we celebrate here tonight. And I'll tell you what happened. It's amazing that somebody mentioned about, I think Brian mentioned about how simple the problem really is and how simple the solution is. But my God, what a critically important thing timing is. And I'll tell you what happened to start turning me around. I'll tell you this first. I believe, there's obviously no way to prove it, but I believe without one iota of doubt, that had my finding a new life, had my finding Alcoholics Anonymous required 1 ounce of initiative for me, I would have never come. I couldn't have possibly asked anybody for help. I couldn't ask anybody for a drink of water. I was so full of guilt. No way I would have ever even conceptualized trying to do something. And so I am tremendously thankful for professionals who deal with people who know how to tell an alcoholic what he ought to do. And here's what happened to me. I'm sitting in that cell, and all I'm doing is just sitting there reading anything I can read, anything to keep from thinking. And so I got a call one day to go out for an interview, and that was fairly routine stuff. And this fellow called me out, did one of those social history type things. And when he got through, he made the same diagnosis that everybody who had ever talked to me made. He used different words, but it all meant the same thing. It would always be something like, man, you sure drink a lot, or you're a bad drunk, or you're a problem drinker. And this guy said essentially the same thing. He said, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. And I said, yeah. And I mean, that was obvious. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I just thought I was worthless. Yeah. But normally what I'd always heard was, why don't you quit drinking? Well, that never made sense to me. It was bad enough drunk. Sober, it wasn't appealing at all. And so he didn't stop there. He said, when he got through, he said, "We have an AA group here at the institution, and I think you ought to go." Now, it wasn't an order. It wasn't something where you're going to mandate me in and say, if you don't go, you'll never get out of here. None of that. They hadn't invented pressure tactics back then much. And so he just made it kind of just a flat declarative statement. So you've got had a lot of problems. You've got a group, you ought to go. I'd never heard of AA. I'd never heard of anybody helping a drunk. You don't help drunks. You put them in cages. You hit them upside the head with blackjacks. That's what you do with drunks. That's all I'd ever seen. Now, that certainly I predated, I give away my age somewhat, I predated detox, I predated rehab, I predated any of that kind of stuff where folks would sort of take initiative and reach in. I heard, after I got sober, I heard there was a treatment thing for rich folks somewhere, but it wasn't in my world. And it wasn't in anybody else's world much at that time. If you tried to put an alcoholic in a hospital, it'd put you in jail. You know, so it was primitive times. And so I had never heard of AA. And so he said that. I don't think he knew anything about it. Somebody told him, when you get a case, it's about booze, the record that thick, tell him I ought to go to AA. That's exactly what he did. Thank God for that man. The amazing thing to me is that you heard the kind of case I am. I was a wild and crazy character. I had committed an unpardonable crime. I was as undeserving as a human could be. I responded to the first invitation I ever heard and have never looked back. It's an amazing thing to me about how profound, but how most profound things are simple, eh? Yeah, and that was profoundly simple. And he said that. It didn't make any impact. I know he didn't explain it, but I really don't think he knew what it was. He just knew he was supposed to tell people like me that they ought to go. And he sent me a note a little later. That was a huge prison. There were 6,000 something, over 6,000 men locked up in that behind one wall. And when you take the worst of the worst population from the worst cities in a state, you do not have a theme park. You got a kind of a bad news place. And it was a huge place, 6,000 guys, it was a big group. And you had to be... You had to be cleared so that you would have room in the meeting. And so I didn't know any of this till afterward, but he sent me a note, a little piece of paper, and said, "You can go to your first meeting February 2nd of 57. I didn't want to go to AA. Yeah, I did not want to go to AA. What I wanted to do was sit in that cell and stare at my navel and do anything to keep from thinking. People who are severely isolated are not attracted by warm, frivolous fellowship. That is not an appealing thing. That's not something you yearn to do. Isolated people want to get somewhere and stay there." And so I was not interested in going to anything. Alcoholics Anonymous had no clue what it was, but it just didn't sound attractive to me. Secret drunks. Who wants to be one of those? I guess that was what was going on in my mind. But thank God for surrender. Thank God for defeat. Thank God for being wiped out in every department of my life. Because I was blessed with having no fight left. No fight. And so I responded to that by just wandering over to the meeting. No aspirations about doing anything. I was kind of spooked about it because I thought it was going to be some kind of a religious hootenanny of some kind. And I wasn't interested in religious hootenannies. When I was a little kid, I promised myself, I didn't connect well with organized religion. And I was a guy that I promised if I ever got big enough to not be drugged to church, that I wouldn't bother those folk anymore. And I kept that vow. I never darkened the door of anything that even rhymed with organized religion till I was 11 years sober. And so when I'm telling you I was bit deep, I mean that. And so when I walked in, I just knew there was going to be just a flock of do-gooders just swarming me as soon as I walked in there. Nobody spoke to me. There were 300 people in the meeting, and the only guy I spoke to him was a correction officer on the door. He said, "Iverson." I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, sit down. Listen to my first meeting. Had no clue what to expect, just as well. Wouldn't have believed it anyway. We ran it similar to, it wasn't as attractive a place. Group wasn't quite as good looking, but it was 300 folks sitting in there. They didn't look too bad. They were all dressed just exactly alike. And so I fit right in. And then they started to meet, and they read a lot of stuff. God knows they read everything but the local newspaper. And they got through with all that. That sounded churchy to me. First thing they did was pray. It wasn't a real huge prayer. It's the one we've been closing the meeting with, the string of prayers, what they did. It's not a big prayer, but it was big to me. Because while they were praying, I was saying to myself, I knew it. I knew that's what they're going to be doing. And then they introduced the speaker, and he was without doubt the wildest alcoholic I've ever seen since. I mean, he was just a wild man. I could not figure out what the guy was doing. I mean, here he is with 300 hairy-legged convicts, and he's up there pouring his heart out to people like us. And I thought, why would he do that? And what he was doing was telling his story. But he might as well have been speaking Farsi for what I knew. And the guy was ranting on, and I couldn't figure out why. When I left, I was probably more confused than I was when I went in. And next week, I found myself back. Nobody sent for me. Nobody would have cared. Nobody would have even known I was missing. I was just another lost face in the chair. And it didn't mean a thing to anybody whether I was there or not. But I found myself drawn back. And the one thing that drew me back, I didn't identify with one syllable of anything that man said. What drew me back was the magical spirit of enthusiasm that imbued his life. That man was absolutely on fire with enthusiasm. He was the delegate for the state of Michigan when he spoke at my first meeting. He became my first sponsor about a year later. But it took a year for me to even get up nerve to speak to him. And so it was not anything of identification. I was in AA for 2 years before I ever heard one single alcoholic with whom I identified. And when I did, I don't know if it's logical or not, but when I did, it was a guy as unlike me as could possibly be in terms of experience. This guy had never been in jail. He never sold his blood for $5 a pint. This guy wouldn't even know what that meant. That would have been an unthinkable thing for him. And yet, when he told his story, he's the first one I identified with. Because what he was talking about was not circumstances, not what all he'd done in the Wild West stuff of it. What he was talking about was what it's like to die on the inside. That's what alcohol is about. It's not about the zoo-like stuff that goes on. It's about dying on the inside and about being consumed with fear, riddled with anxiety and anger about everything and nothing. An omnipresent guilt, and that's what he was talking about in the few minutes that he spoke. And thank God for that man. He never came back, but he came once, and he was the first guy that I really connected with. And so I was into the group. I was extremely fortunate in that the group that I went into in a maximum custody penitentiary was an excellent AA group. And in all honesty, it is probably a stronger group than 90% that I visit today. An excellent group. Is a group that understood the fifth tradition, that a group has but one primary purpose, and that's to carry his message to the alcoholic still suffering. That group did a great job of that, as good as any I've ever seen. And what those fellows did, they didn't wait till I got ready and ask for anything. What they did was just sort of led me into the, I'm talking about other guys locked up just like me, but they'd gotten into doing some 12-step work. And so they would take new guys in, get them off in a separate room, and talk about the program, about what it is, and explain it and all that. And that was extremely helpful for me. First place I ever heard the term design for living. And for a guy that was as totally empty spiritual for me, it was awfully refreshing and important for me to hear a logical thing like design for living as opposed to some heavenly magic show that had no meaning for me. And so that was an extremely important thing. What the guy said, In introducing, I remember to this day, all these years later, I remember when they were talking about that, they said that the steps have 200 words in them. And if you take the actions laid out in those words, when you get through, you'll be a different guy. Now, you'll be the same old dude, but you'll have a whole different outlook on life. You'll have what we call a spiritual awakening. Your spirit will be awakened. You'll have almost like a different mind about the way you go at things. And they said, and I found it to be true, your motives make no difference. And how true that is. It's been so long since I've even wasted one second of thought about anybody's motives. None of my business. None of my business why anybody comes in that door. That's their own problem. My business is to sort of let them know that a broken life can get healed here. That's my business. And so I was introduced to that and got very active in that group. I didn't intend to, but a good group will take care of getting you involved and getting you active. And those guys just kind of nudged me around and started pushing me into stuff, and I got into it. I'm nowhere near where I wanted to go, and I have no clue what time it is. So I'm just going to race ahead, and somebody signal me when it's time to quit. I quit on command anyway. And otherwise, I'll just go till I get someplace that looks like a stop, and then I'll just quit mid-sentence. I mean, I'll just flat quit. Won't recite any poetry or anything. I got in that group, and I'll tell you what happened. I'll kind of bracket this a little bit and make the point, because I think this group knows well enough what we're talking about. You know, when I look at the steps, I'm going to break them into three groups. When I look at the steps, I like to look at them as sort of units of recovery, of units of recovery. Like the first three steps, I look at as a package deal. They have to do with accepting defeat, of admitting my hopelessness, admitting that I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable. Critically important, that's the foundation of the whole deal. And then it follows immediately with what I was describing in some detail, is it calls to find a power that makes sense to me, not to somebody else, with no dogma, no creed, no ritual. Find a power that you believe can save your mutton. And then if you find that power, simply decide to use the power. And what those three steps do, to me, is they constitute the foundation. In my mind, they're not really recovery. They basically stop the bleeding and give a solid base from which a new life can be launched. Critically important. Now, please understand this as I go through this right quick. There is no quality control here. Nobody's going to tell you that you passed or failed. Booze will take care of that. And so we don't do that with each other. In this program, you stop at whatever you're willing to settle for. Stop at whatever you're willing to settle for. I've known people who never read the book. I knew one guy that was his badge of honor, that he never read the book. He'd greet a newcomer and say, I never have read that book. He didn't need to tell them that you could tell by looking that he had never read that book. And at least he had that to be proud of. And so you stop at whatever you're willing to settle for. Now, I could not have stopped at those first three steps. I'm an aggravated case. I am not somebody that's just sort of can get into some. I didn't drink like that. I drank like a wild man running wide open. I think my recovery has to somewhat match my chemical kind of drive or whatever that is, my compulsivity or name it. But if I tried to go to one meeting a week, I'd go brain dead, man. I wouldn't last a hot minute. And so I couldn't have gotten by with three steps. I'm not that kind of a drunk. I'm somebody whose mind is an enemy. And just like we read somewhere earlier, that when I don't drink, I don't get better. I get worse, for God's sakes. I get worse. So I'm somebody who needed to go on. So I got that little foundation. It was shaky at best. My God, it was just a furtive kind of hold on something like a drowning man. But it was enough to start. Place in our book that says something vital, that the only thing required is just about that much willingness. Just a willingness to even question, just a willingness to believe that there might be something. And that's enough to get started. Thank God for that. Because what that does is cracks the door where a new life can start. And so I got that little foundation in place. And then moved into, I'll just talk about the next four as one kind of a unit. And not to trivialize them, because some of the most important stuff in my life happened in 4 through 7. Where that inventory for me was an overwhelmingly important thing. When I did it, like most good things I've done in my life, I didn't intend to. But I went to a meeting, got spent the whole meeting talking about inventory, and it resonated somehow, I guess. And I'd read the stuff. I've always been a reader. And so I read the stuff, and so when I left the meeting, I was kind of thoughtful about it, and I said, well, I'm going to go do it. I meant to write a little saga about the tragedy of my life. That's what I meant to do. I didn't mean to do any life-changing work. I meant to do something that I could readily share with the world about, man, you don't know how bad it is. You know, let me show you this. The founders were wise when they said, write the inventory. Because I tell you, if you can write yourself a lie like I was getting ready to tell, you really got problems. You know? So I wrote what I had in mind. I wrote two lines. And this is exactly the way it happened. With absolutely no thought, no planning, no preparation, other than just, you know, the stuff I'd done reading the book. With no preparation, all at once, I had what's described a lot of different ways. Sometimes call it a moment of clarity. But when all at once, I guess I saw the foolishness of the charade of my life. Because it just came into focus, and I didn't dwell on it. But it just sort of glaringly stood there, I guess. And I just quit. And in one motion, with no thought whatsoever, I just opened up and poured out my heart. That's all. Nothing real deep or complicated. No columns, no evaluation, or none of that. What it was a tortured young fellow pouring out his heart. That's all. I was pouring out my life. And I'll tell you this. That is without question the most important day's work this fellow has ever done, bar none. Bar none. More important than the day I married, when my kids were born, when my career started, and when it finished. More important than any of that, because everything in my life suspends from what I'm telling you right now. And when I got through with that inventory, those things that had been shaky at best in the first three steps became solid. They became solid. I experienced a profound awareness at depth. You know, that little line I read in chapter 3 that said, we learn we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic, the first step in recovery. That's exactly what I did that day. Prior to that time, I just sort of admitted it, like pleading guilty to it, not down to what that said. You know, I told you my name's Tom Iverson, an alcoholic. That's not conceding. That's communication. That's all that is. Conceding is where I accepted at a cellular level that I'm beat. I am beat. I didn't wise up and decide drinking beats or not drinking beats this. Forget that. I accepted at the core of my being that I'm alcoholic. I'm somebody for whom a drink means self-destruction and often destruction of others. You know, I have no illusions about that. And so that thing settled deeply where I conceded. Conceded is a private word. That's not something you announce to the world. I privately accepted defeat. Hear this. Over 48 years later, I have never for one second doubted that fact. That war was over, fellow alcoholics. That war was over. Never to be resumed unless I make one mistake that I can't afford, and that's take another drink. Otherwise, I'm physically okay. If I go through an MRI or CAT scan, I look like anybody else. But put a drink in me and something happens. So that fight was done. And I'm not somebody who decided that he won't drink. I'm somebody who decided that he can't drink. And that's peace. That's peace. And then what that leaves me, the rest of what started to come out that day is just like the book says, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind. And I have a mind that's just absolutely hard to contain. And man alive, I hate to think where I would have been if I had just gone on with that, just the fact that I can't drink. Yo, gee whiz. But I started to recognize, at least got a glimpse at those defects of characters that own me. That was a tremendously important juncture for me. And then when step 5 came up, I fished around a lot, put it off for a couple of months. But I didn't want to take a fifth step, you know, where I sit down with another human and tell them deep, dark secrets about myself. You know, stuff had come out in my inventory that I'd never thought of. And so I'm going to sit down with a human, something I had never done in my entire life. and I'm locked up in a maximum custody penitentiary. There were a lot of people there that would have readily listened to me, but most of whom I wasn't willing to talk to. And so I had a real close friend in the program at that time. And after going through a lot of conversation with him, it dawned on me that's the guy I ought to be talking to. And say we ought to be careful about this step. I was. I picked another inmate in a maximum custody penitentiary. And they say we ought to be thoughtful about time and place. So I was. We sat down on a bench in a prison yard with 6,000 people wandering around. And I opened up for the first time in my entire life to another human being. And when we got through, that man knew me far better than my mother knew me. And what happened was a little crack in that wall of self-centered isolation appeared. Tightest prison, tightest confinement that I was ever in my life was not some cage somebody put me in. That's a circumstance. The prison of my life was the prison that was all confining. And that day was the first crack where that started to open up and I could be a part of life around me. Hugely important. And then 6 and 7 are essentially about, you know, like if 4 and 5 are basically doing the autopsy on it, you're sort of seeing what's going on with this guy. And now I've gotten through that, and I've put a face on my alcoholism. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I know what I'm talking about. I'm somebody who drank a lot, of course. But I am also somebody who's driven by forces I don't even understand, so that my mind will turn irresistibly to the thought of a drink if I let it go unattended. And I started to have that awareness. And so what follows immediately after 4 and 5 is what I call decision time. Some people skip over these steps rather lightly, but I think they are pivotal steps. They're the fulcrum of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because what they do, okay, you've taken a look. You've admitted that you got big-time trouble. You've taken a look. You've seen what it looks like. And the question is, do you want to change or don't you? You want to get well or don't you? Are you willing to do what's right just because it's right, or aren't you? You're willing to say yes when no is so easy, or say no when yes is so easy, or aren't you? It's decision time. And I'd labored over that. You know, I mean, I knew I wanted to get rid of some defects, but I wasn't sure about all of them. I mean, some of them I kind of liked. And I thought, my God, if I get rid of all my defects of character, I won't have any character, because that's all I had. And so I labored over it a bit. But the steps designed to be quick and hit them and go. And mine was not particularly quick. I agonized, and then I got deep down that I, honest to God, want a different life. I am sick of this, and I want a different life. And so that was a hugely important thing where stuff started to happen. And what that does is open up for the part of the program that I love most of all, I guess. But it's the thing. And we got into some this afternoon that I like to think about the recovery, the restoration steps, the freedom steps. Because when we get through with 6 and 7, we're through romancing the illness and studying ourselves, and it's time to start looking at the healing process. That's why it's so important to have that decision that, yes, I do want to get better. And then I might be willing to make the drastic steps that are required. All it requires me to do is to list the people, places, and things to whom I've inflicted injury. Now you saw that I had a grievous list of people. When I first looked at it, I thought it was going to be it looked like the phone book. I thought, my God, man, I've hurt so many people, I can't even remember them all. Realistically, when I started to write down, you know, when I do an 8-step, I tell you what I do. I put 3 columns. It's not in the book anywhere, but I use 3 columns. One is I want to put the name of the person, place, or institution. I want to make it personal. So I name it. I don't deal with global guilt. I like to get really like to get specific. So I want to put the name down. Next column, I want to put what's the wrong. What did I do? Specifically, what did I do? And then list that. And that's what the list to me is about. And then the question, the third thing is, how can I make it right? What can I do to make it right? And so when I do that, I'm ready to make amends. Until I get it down into functional kinds of terms like that, I'm not going anywhere. You know, I'll just sort of model around with it. And so So that was a tremendously important thing. That process began for me when I was locked up like a wild animal, because all restitution was not locked out. There were things I could do. And I wish I had time to talk more about that, but I really won't. I'd like to tell you about, because I know a lot of people have trouble getting through amends and have fears about getting through. Let me just tell you this, that there is absolutely nothing in my life today that's eating my lunch. There is nothing that interferes with my being a free man. None. I was able to make complete amends to the people that I killed and to the families that survived. And this is a powerful deal that we've got here. Now, there's a lot more to that than that, but just take that to the bank, that I'm a free man. I heard, Bill, one of the few advantages of being old is in the program. I was and attended my first conference in Toronto in 65, primarily to meet Bill. And I heard him talking about these steps. And what he said was that if you'll take these actions as they're laid out, when you get through, you'll be a free man. You'll be able to walk the streets of this earth and look any human being that you meet in the eye. Now, that was a far journey from where I was. I was about up to kneecaps. And he said, you'll come a time you'll be able to say to any human, and I'd say it to you, ask me anything you care to ask me. I've got nothing hidden. Call that whatever you want, folks. That is freedom. That is freedom. To breathe free and deep, free of guilt. My earnest belief is, and I'll just throw this in for whatever it's worth, my earnest belief is that I would never be free. I don't care how long I'm sober. I would never be free until I go back and make right those wrongs. It ain't going to happen. I've got to go back and make right. Otherwise, I drag them forever. And then we move on into, again, I'd love to visit them, but not to the real action steps of 10, 11, and 12. Where these principles become a way of life, and I start really working on being a worthwhile person. I was sharing with a friend today about, you know, what I do, and I'll just kind of cap it around this, that I really believe what I was talking about earlier about putting these principles to work as a way of life. You know, I don't work steps. I practice the principles of these steps in everything that I do, every moment of my life. And specifically what I do every morning, I've got a little pond. I wanted to buy that pond a while back, and it cost quite a lot of money. To my wife, it sounded like quite a lot of money, and she kept complaining about it. And so never could get her to agree, so I gave it to her for her 33rd wedding anniversary. And she took it in reasonably good spirit, but she said, good try, big guy, you know. But I wanted that pond, you know. As I got it, it bubbles away with a waterfall out there, and that's where I get my day started. And every day that I can, I go out there and sit by that pond, and I do my meditation and prayer, and it's a pretty simple transaction. What I do is talk to my higher power, and I ask for three things that I want to center my life around every day. One, I want to be reminded and be mindful of what I've been given here. I'm not somebody who socializes in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm somebody who has an illness that will take me out of here in a heartbeat. I have an illness for which I've been given a solution that most people in this world never even know about. Most alcoholics die of this illness, never knowing there's a way out. For whatever reason, God saw fit to give me this gift. And so every morning I try to reflect on that. And it's not morbid, it's just sort of touching base that I'm a guy who ought not to be here. But by the grace of God, I've been given a way of life. And so I get that in my mind. And then the second thing I ask for is to help me go through the day that I might carry myself in a way that would be worthy of the gift. I don't want to be somebody crashing through life and making AA look like an unattractive way to be. I want to be somebody who carries himself in a way that people could say, hey, I wouldn't mind having some of that. That's what I want to do. And I want to be, and the third thing I ask for is to be sensitive to opportunities to be of service. And I'll tell you this, it's a rare day a rare day that I don't run into many people who are in need badly of service. Sometimes it's a kind word. Sometimes it's a friendly greeting. Sometimes it's a smile. Just simple little things. But sometimes those simple little things will make somebody's day. So I want to be in that kind of a spirit so that I can recognize stuff. And let me just get you out of there and then tell you it doesn't take a lot of brain power to get out of jail. It just takes a lot of time. And so I finally got released. And I stayed in maximum custody the whole time I was in there. I wasn't a bad actor. I was a pretty good citizen. But, yeah, I was a strong member of AA. I became a real strong member of AA in that group. And when I got out, I knew exactly where I was going. So they released me in Michigan on condition that I go to North Carolina, where I live now. And so I agreed and went down there. I'm a big city guy. I didn't want to go back to Mayberry. But I went and got immediately active in AA. And I want to just tell you in a rush about, sometimes I know that hope wavers. Hope is fewer, is kind of flimsy. I want you to know that miracles genuinely happen. Now, I'm a pretty practical guy. I'm a pretty pragmatic type of guy. I'm not somebody who gets into a whole bunch of magic tricks and stuff. But I believe that miracles happen. I don't believe it. I know that miracles happen. Because the guy I'm going to tell you about is the guy who walked out of a maximum custody penitentiary. The second week I'm out, I'm in a prison. Well, looked like I was carrying a message. I was just carrying a scared body is what I was doing, but I was there. And 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor. A position of trust in service that was unimaginable. I couldn't have been more affirmed if I'd been elected governor of my state. And it was a tremendous, tremendous feeling. About the same time, for obvious reason, when I had been paroled from the state of Michigan, the parole department there put in letters this big on my probate: this man's never operated a motor vehicle for apparent reason. And this man's never drink alcoholic beverages for apparent reason. I took those as facts of life. 2 months after I was out, my parole supervisor, I guess he'd seen what I was like, and he came to me and said, "Tom, you're real active in this AA thing." And I thought he was going to tell me I ought to slow down. I knew it wouldn't. And he said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" And I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't," as if he didn't know. And he said, "Let me check that out." A little later, he called me and asked me to meet him at the Sears store uptown where my folks lived. And so I went up. My sister drove me up, and I went there, and my guy was standing back there with a license guy. And this story is absolutely true. She pulled up. I could see my guy. I got out, went back there. He was chatting with the man I didn't know. And so they got through chatting and turned and greeted me. And the fellow I didn't know said, "I understand you wouldn't mind having your license to drive." And I said, "Well, yes, sir." True. And he handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. Didn't pay for it. Had no road test. I mean, I just said, "You want to drive?" and handed me a license. I know that can't be legal. There's got to be more to it than that. But I've been driving ever since. What I believe, I believe that miracles are what happens when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction. When preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction, things happen beyond my comprehension. I also believe, you hear what I'm saying now because I don't want to inflame this, but I believe that when God's got work for me to do, whatever walls interfere with that will come down. I don't care what they are. When God's got work for me to do and service for me to perform, the walls will come down. I know that not only on my own experience, but God knows how many hundreds of others. 5 months after I was out, I was elected to district committeeman. Same guy who ever wondered if he would ever have a friend or be trusted. and I'm asked to be the trusted servant in 12 cities in my state. Tremendous honor. 2 years after I was out, I was sitting home one day, minding my own business, active as a person could be, and I got a phone call from our state capitol. And there was a man on the phone that I had met him one time for about 2 or 3 minutes, but I didn't know him at all. And he got me on the phone, and he said, "Mr. Ivester, we are expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would accept a position." Now, let me tell you what's unbelievable news about that. As of that day, there had never been an ex-con anywhere on this planet hired into a correction system. Now, I knew that. And so the first thing I said to him was, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, we've checked you out." And of course they had. And to him I said, "My God, man, I'd rather do that than anything I could imagine." And to myself, I said, "There ain't no way." But when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I was employed as the first ex-con on this planet working in a prison. It's a strange position to be in when you're in a land where nobody has gone before. And a strange place. A tradition served me well. And I had a marvelous career. I didn't even know if they paid. I never did ask them if they paid. I'd have done it for nothing. And so I just started a career. And I never did have a lot of ambition about anything. I'd finished 2 years at Michigan State while I was locked up. And I wasn't really eaten up with credentials or anything like that, but I was eaten up with zeal, and I was a real. I've never met a lot of people that I would outthink, but I've met an awful lot of people that I outwork, and I outworked a lot of folks, and not from ambition. I was just absolutely loving what I did, and what happens when you do good work, you'll tend to start getting moved up, and I started getting moved up into supervision, then to management, and stuff like that. And one day, the head of our system, it was one thing to be I was working in rehabilitation, is what they called it then. I was doing a lot of stuff in that area. And one day, the head of our prison system asked me to come by his office, said, "I got an assignment I'd like you to take." And I said, "Yes, sir." "And what is it?" And he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take over a prison as warden." Now, I tell you, even though I was in the system, that is an unthinkable concept. Of all the things that a guy may daydream about in a penitentiary, that is not one of them. No way. And when I got up off the floor, I said, "Boss, come on, man. I don't want to be the head guard here. I mean, I want to duke it out with the guys." And I said, "Tell me what you got in mind." He told me it had just enough creativity to it that it appealed to me. And I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And the unbelievable thing is, one thing to be in rehabilitation and restoration type of work. It's quite another when you're the man with the Uzi, and that's a weird kind of a feeling. And I did that for the next 20 years of my career. I did that kind of stuff. And then got ready to retire, and they asked me to stay on and do some other stuff at statewide level. And so I had a marvelous career. I put in 39 years in a career that 10 years past retirement. I wouldn't have traded it with Bill Gates. It was a marvelous career and had a great time. Now I'm just an average guy. I'm unemployed now. I retired, and the folk in AA heard I was retiring. They elected me to be the chairman of AA and Corrections the day I retired. And so I did. And so I have never been busier in my life than I am right now. And I wouldn't trade that for anything, because I'll guarantee you I'm having more fun than the average cat. I'm a regular walking around guy. I've got a family. I got a wife that we've just celebrated 37 years of continuous marriage just last July, and that's a wonderful thing that I never thought would happen. Got a couple of kids that I thought were airheads when they were growing up, and they were, but they got through it. And one of them went kind of bad. She's a psychologist, and she's proud of her though. She's doing great work with development of disabled kids. And I have a son that looked like a wonderful potential member of AA. And I don't know what happened to him. I think he fell off the bunk in college or something. That just lost all of his extra chromosomes that make AA members. Yeah, he majored in fraternity the first year. And he was elected King Reggae in Jamaica. My wife said, "Isn't that awful?" I said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, that's terrible." Yeah. Inside, I said, "Yeah, that's my boy." I could just see him chairing a meeting or something. I thought, but he's like Marlon Brando. He could have been a contender. And instead, he decided to go into medicine. And now that airhead is... He's a high-risk maternal fetal medicine specialist. I could barely pronounce that. And this guy just did surgery on a fetus in a womb. And he's telling me about that, and I'm thinking, you dopey kid, there is no way that you... But it's amazing. You know, some people think if you've got a dynamic, active life in AA, you pay a penalty. I'm here to tell you that that's not true. What we do is live by principles. And if I'm operating by principles, AA does not compete with anything in my life. There is nothing in my life, and I've been as busy as any man I have ever known for as long as any man I've ever known. And there is nothing in my life that has not been richly blessed, professionally, socially, financially, family, you name it. My life has been enriched. All I did was come here and give a broken and wasted life to this marvelous program. And what it did was give me back a life beyond anything I could have imagined in my wildest dreams. Deeply grateful for that. If you're somebody that's not on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sakes, don't let this thing go by. Don't worry about what people think or any of that stuff. Lay back your ears and jump in this sucker and give it a real ride. No matter how much you put in, I'll guarantee you, you'll get back more.